220. Given the present popular praise of disinterestedness, we must bring to mind, perhaps not without a certain danger, what it is that really interests the populace, and what in general are those things about which the common man is fundamentally and deeply concerned, including educated people, even scholars, and, unless all appearance deceive, perhaps philosophers as well. From that fact it turns out that the vast majority of what interests and charms more refined and discriminating tastes and every higher nature seems totally uninteresting to the average man. Nonetheless, when he notices a devotion to these things, he calls it désintéressé, disinterested, and wonders to himself how it is possible to act without interest. There have been philosophers who have known how to confer a seductive and mystically transcendental form of expression upon this popular wonder, perhaps because in their own experience they knew nothing of higher nature, instead of presenting what's reasonable, the honest, naked truth that the disinterested action is a very interesting and interested action, provided... And love? What's that? Is even an action done from love supposed to be unegoistic? You idiots! What about the praise for those who make sacrifices? But anyone who has really made a sacrifice knows that he wanted and got something for it. Perhaps something of himself in exchange for something of himself. He gave up here in order to have more there. Perhaps in general to be more, or at least to feel himself as more. But this is a realm of questions and answers in which a more discriminating guest does not like to remain. For here even truth already finds it necessary to suppress her yawns if she must answer. In the last analysis, truth is a woman. We should not treat her with force. 221. It so happens, said a moralistic pedant and pettifogger, that I respect and honour a selfless man, not because he is selfless, but because he seems to me to have a right to be of use to another man at his own expense. All right, but it's always a question of who he is and who the other is. For example, in a man who is marked out and made to command, self-denial and modest holding back would not be a virtue but a waste of virtue. That's what it seems like to me. Every unegoistic morality which takes itself unconditionally and applies itself to everyone not only sins against taste, it also provokes sins of omission, one more seduction under the guise of philanthropy, and in particular a seduction for and injury to the higher, rarer, and privileged people. We must compel moralities first and foremost to give way before the order of rank. We must force into the conscience of moralities an awareness of their own presumption, until they finally are collectively clear about the fact that it is immoral to say, what's right for one man is fair to another. As for my moralistic pedant and fine little man, does he deserve it when people laugh at him as he advises moralities in this way to become moral? But people should not be too much in the right if they want those who laugh on their side. A small grain of wrong is even a part of good taste. 222. Nowadays, wherever people preach pity, and if one listens correctly, is there any other religion preached any more, the psychologist should keep his ears open. Through all the vanity, through all the noise characteristic of these preachers, like all preachers, he'll hear a hoarser, moaning, genuine sound of self-contempt. It's part of that process of making Europe dark and ugly, which has been growing now for 100 years, and whose first symptoms were already placed in the documentary record in a thoughtful letter from Galliani to Madame d'Epinay, unless it's the cause of this development. The man of modern ideas, this proud ape, is uncontrollably dissatisfied with himself. That's established. He's suffering, and his vanity wishes him only to suffer with others. 223. At any rate, the hybrid European man, a reasonably ugly plebeian, all in all, needs a costume. He needs history as a pantry for costumes. Naturally, he then notices that none of them fits his body properly. He changes and changes. Just take a look at the 19th century, at the rapid preferences and changes in the masquerade of style, along with the moments of despair over the fact that nothing suits us. It's no use presenting oneself romantically or classically or in a Christian or Florentine or Baroque or national manner in moribus et artibus, in customs and the arts. It doesn't suit us. But the spirit, in particular the historical spirit, still sees an advantage for itself, even in this despair. Over and over again, a new piece of prehistory and a foreign country are explored, put on, set aside, packed away, and above all, studied. We are the first age with an academic training in costume. I mean in moralities, articles of faith, tastes in art and religions. Prepared as no other time ever was for a carnival in the grand style, for a spiritual revelry of laughter and high spirits, for a transcendental height of the loftiest nonsense and Aristophanic mockery of the world. Perhaps this is the very place where we'll still discover the realm of our own inventiveness, that realm where we too can still be original as some sort of satirists of world history and God's clowns. Perhaps when nothing else today has a future, perhaps it's our laughter that still has one.